Blog Talk Radio.
Wondered what it would be like to meditate in a cave in the mountains of the Himalayas all by yourself? What might you discover about the depths of the human spirit? Stay tuned for an enlightening conversation about a journey inward to the source. Welcome to the Healthy Baby Boomers Network Blog Talk Radio Show. I'm your host, Dr. Erica Goodstone, licensed mental health counselor, love mentor and relationship healer, somatic body psychotherapist, and health and wellness coach, helping men and women heal their bodies and their relationships through love. Author of the Love Me, Touch Me, Heal Me book series, the romantic novel Love in the Blizzard of Life, and creator of Love Lessons for the Soul and many virtual summit packages and the Love Mastery series blueprint. This show is all about living your dreams, fulfilling your life purpose, and creating and sustaining love and health and total well-being for the rest of your life, no matter what age you are right now. In every episode, I speak with vibrant, exciting, and positive men and women who are proving that life can and often does get better and better as we reach our 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and beyond. In 1996, meditation teacher Ajayan Bose journeyed to the source of the Ganges River high in India's Himalayas. Intent on self-realization, he discovered a deserted cave in a Himalayan forest, and for 2 months he lived there alone, meditating in silence, surviving on one sparse meal each day. Through unexpected friendships with holy men, encounters with madmen and the Indian army, surviving harsh mountain conditions, including scorpions and mind-numbing cold, he was open to the depths of the human spirit and to universal insights that he calls the whispers of the Himalayas. Ajayan has instructed and guided thousands of students in North America, Australia, Europe, and India. He is founder of Effortless Mind Meditation, host of Mind Matters Radio on Alternative Talk Radio 1150 KKNW, and author of several books, including Whispers of the Himalayas. So, for me, it's an absolute pleasure to welcome you, Ajayan Bose.
Thank you so much, Dr. Erica. It's a beautiful introduction, and I love to hear all of your accomplishments. That's amazing.
Oh, thank you. And you said something before we get into it. I just felt I had to do this. I was just reading it a few minutes before getting on the call. An experience you had inside the cave. You were about to meditate in silence, and these two people appeared. They dropped in, and you were irritated by them. And I thought, how funny, because I'm irritated by so many things. I'm teaching about love, and I could be so irritated and judgmental and notice that. So it's funny. You can't get away from it, even in the mountains.
Absolutely. Well, you know, you bring your mind wherever you go. And that the mind is the thing that you have to be cautious about and be ever watchful of and, you know, be working on. Because sometimes it can, you know, pull some funny tricks.
So that just really struck me, that little incident. I can't wait to hear the rest. But first, please tell us about your background, education, training. What led you to start meditating, then to travel to the Himalayas, and then you can tell us what that experience was like for you.
Sure. All right. Actually, I have to take it back to, well, as far as education, I have my bachelor's in philosophy and psychology, basically. And it was an interdisciplinary degree that I did at a experimental college in Washington State, Fairhaven College, where I could create my own major. And during the course of that study, I traveled the world and spent a lot of time with the founder of the Transcendental Meditation Movement. So that's the educational part. So actually, it was a degree in meditation is what it really amounted to. But but I have to go even further back to what really interested me in meditation in the first place. And for that, I have to take you to an experience that I had as a senior in high school. Back then, this was in 1970, I was in with a crowd that did not hesitate to explore with the little psychedelic drugs. And so we had done this for maybe, I don't know, a few months of exploration. And it wasn't with a spirit really of seeking as much as kind of thrills in a way, to be honest. So nothing, mm-hmm. nothing great about it. But what happened one time, the last time I ever did it actually, and was that I don't know how much detail you want me to go into, but you stop me
sure.
if I'm going into too much detail. But this story takes a few minutes to really convey in its full. So what happened was we were having this lovely conversation that was very superfluid in the sense that one person could say a few words and it would convey a complex idea, then other people would chime in, and we just kept building on this, and there was a lot of love and a sense of unity. And at a certain point in the conversation, I found that my thinking sort of became too, what I thought of as too fast to speak it out. So I dropped out of the conversation, and I was just sitting there, and my mind was kind of whirling around in these inner truths that seemed very profound, and I actually don't know exactly what they were, but the very profound truths. And as I was thinking this, I was experiencing more and more love and more sort of a blissful feeling. And it just became very intense. And then at another point, the thoughts became too fast, again, is what how I thought of it, too subtle. I don't know what you might describe that as, but it was it became too fast and subtle for language. So I actually wasn't thinking in terms of language, which ordinarily we do. You know, you think a thought and you can speak it out. So at the subtle level of your thought, it is still in language. But now my thoughts were not in language, and they were just these pure currents of intelligence and energy. And they were revolving around some inner core faster and faster. And as this was happening, I was feeling just indescribable love, indescribable bliss. And at the same time, I felt like I was onto the very secret of the universe. And that's not an exaggeration. That's what it felt like. And then in one moment, it was as if I touched into that core. And then there was a gap. And I will tell you by metaphor what that gap contained. So imagine that you are the sun. Okay, the sun is a million times bigger than the earth, I'm told, so it's huge. And let's say instead of just light and energy, you are pure intelligence, pure clear light, pure love, pure energy as well, and pure bliss. And even so you're this mass a million times bigger than the earth of those qualities. But still, somewhere you would end and space would begin. So let's say you're a trillion suns, incomprehensible. We can't even imagine that. A trillion suns of pure intelligence, energy, bliss, love, and light. And still there would be an end. Well, this was that, except there was no end. It was infinite, far beyond that trillion suns. And in that entire expanse of infinity, there was not a single stirring, not the slightest ripple. It was absolute peace. And so I was in that for I do not know how long. And I came out and I just whispered, that was God. And I kind of assumed that everybody in the car had had the same experience because we'd all been very unified as we were talking. But of course, no one else had had that. And the interesting thing was that that experience left deeply imprinted on me a few absolute truths that are just totally self-evident. I just knew this. And the first one was that that experience had nothing to do intrinsically with the drug. The drug had opened it up, but no drug can create infinity. That's impossible. So it was a transcendent experience that had its own value far beyond any drug. That was the first thing. The second thing that I knew from that experience was that we can all live that state in some form. I didn't know how exactly, not that we all have to dissolve into nirvana, but I knew that somehow that was meant to be lived, and that was the purpose of life. And so I knew that. And then the final truth that I had was that in order to live that, we have to have I describe it as normal in the highest sense. In other words, we have to cleanse ourselves of any distortion, of any impurity, say, you know, psychological, emotional, maybe even physical. I wasn't sure what that meant. I just knew that I had to be as normal as possible in the highest sense of the word, normal human life, not ordinary human life, but normal. And so I immediately decided that I had to stop all the stuff we were doing as these adventurous high school kids and irresponsible, stop drinking, stop smoking, stop taking these drugs. And I tried to persuade my friends of the same. And of course, they would have nothing to do with it. They wanted to continue. And so I became sort of isolated from my friends, and I became very alone in that last portion of my senior year of high school. And then one day I was looking at my father's bookshelf, and I saw this Slender book there, and I don't know what drew me to it, but I just picked it up, and it was a copy of the Bhagavad Gita. Now, my father was not he didn't study Eastern religion or thought, and it was just happened to be there because he had taken a management course led by a Jesuit priest who had used this as one of the many texts in the course. For some reason, he had put that in their course. Mm-hmm. And so I opened it up and I started to read it, and it was as if I had written it. It was utterly familiar to me. In fact, when I read a book that I have written now, and I've written, you know, four books, and if I read any one of them and pick it up, it seems more foreign to me than that one did to me at that time. That was just describing who I was. It was describing my very pulse. It was just everything. And so I determined then and there, I tried to meditate because the book has some parts about meditation. I failed utterly. And then I started a search, and I started reading other books, some Tibetan books, and I finally decided. And again, they struck me as just expressing this pure truth that I had experienced. So I was drawn to that, and I decided I wanted to go to Tibet and find some lamas to instruct me and all this. But of course, Chinese occupation, and I was just a high school kid, and I didn't have any money to boot, and that would have been crazy because I was supposed to go to college the next quarter. And so I ended up going to college, delaying my plans to go to Tibet. And at college, I saw a poster for meditation, and so I went and took that course, and from that point, just studied it more and more. And I ended up teaching the Transcendental Meditation Program for about 10 years. Then I started exploring other forms of meditation. I ended up living in India, teaching at an ashram in south of India for Amici, you know, the hugging saint. I don't know if anybody who's listening has heard of her, but she is a very popular Indian teacher, and I was the ashram meditation teacher there, and I taught, she had thousands of people coming through there, so I taught many people. I was teaching 7 days a week for about 4 years, and then I would go to the Himalayas, and I studied with different yogis and all of that, and that was the first trip to the yogis is the account in Whispers of the Himalaya. So that, in short, is the backstory.
Wow. So you have really been engrossed in meditation. But I have to share that I did have an intense meditation experience myself at the Shivananda Ashram on Paradise Island, smoking a little pot. It's funny how a drug can stimulate it. And someone was doing some shiatsu on my back, and we had been eating this incredibly healthy, sparse food, vegetarian and light. And I had an experience of what it's like to be a road or a tree or a car. And then I started sending love to everybody I knew. You know, it just suddenly it emerged. So there's a truth that comes out when you're opened up to it.
Exactly. And that is our true nature. And what I've found is that, you know, in time, just through meditation, you can open up to that very beautifully. And then it becomes, so actually, it is not hard to experience the divine. That is the easy part. And once you know the art of meditation, and I do encourage anyone who wants to explore that to get good instruction. You'll save years, if not, I'd almost say it's almost impossible without good instruction. It will be willy-nilly. You might have a good experience here or there, but to really be able to reliably go deep within every time, it's good to have that instruction. So, and then that's possible. Then the challenge becomes to integrate it so that it starts to inform your personality, your thinking, your feeling, and starts to melt down those patterns that we develop over a lifetime, many of which are formed even in childhood and in part through our childhood traumas and such. So all of that is the real challenge. And that's the thing that, you know, I'm working on till this day. But as far as meditation goes, now I've done a lot of that. So I have that part down.
Right, and that's peace that I understand very well, because I got so opened up, I felt like I was having a nervous breakdown, and then I kind of shut down after that when I got back to New York. You know, I saw people in roles, you know, and I just saw too much and kind of shut down, because without that guidance and without the regular practice, that's what you're talking about, and then then integrating it. So let's get back to what was happening in the Himalayas. Like, how did you find a cave, and what was that whole experience like?
Okay. Well, that's a story in itself, finding the cave, I will say, because, you know, I had read a book. First I'll tell you what inspired me to go to the Himalayas. I was teaching at the ashram down in South India, and a friend there, an elderly gentleman that I was friends with, he had taken a break and gone to this place in the Himalayas. It's called Gangotri. It's the very close to the actual physical source of the Ganga, and it is the legendary source of the Ganga. There's this whole story behind how where the Ganga comes from heaven and all, and it flows from, and Shiva breaks the fall of this powerful celestial stream on his head, and then it comes off his head, and it lands in Gangotri. And so in any case, there's a waterfall there where that site is. So he had been there, and it's this beautiful pilgrimage spot at 10,000 feet in the Himalayas. And it has he just came back from there, and he said, Ajayan, you would love this place. It's so beautiful, and it has such a pure energy. And it's just great for meditation. You should go there and get a cave and meditate there. So I thought, sounds good to me. Because I was the ashram meditation teacher, which meant that I was on call like 7 days a week and just very busy. And plus I had other duties there. And there were many thousands of people coming through the ashram. So it was always loud and noisy and crowded and everything. So when he said this, it really, you know, appealed. And I actually was married and I had two children at the time, two daughters, still do, but they're, and in fact, they're living there now, even to this day. This was 1996. And so I talked to them about it, and they were very happy with their lives there. And so they gave me their blessings, and so I headed up to the Himalayas. So that's how I got there. But then I had read a book in the meantime about being in the Himalayas by, I forget the Swami, but he had traveled around with just one thin wool blanket. And so that's basically all I brought. I brought a thin wool blanket plus one of those three-quarter length thermarests that are very thin. And I figured, okay, you know, if he can do it, I can do that. So, but what I didn't know was at 10,000 feet in the night, it gets down to freezing. So anyway, I'll get there. But so I assumed that I would traipse up to Gangotri and find a cave. Not true. What happens is that's the busy season. It was early June. And all the holy men and yogis, the sadhus, they go to these places in the mountains, especially Gangotri, because it's such a pilgrimage spot, and they grab the caves. So when I got there, there wasn't a vacant cave. It would have been easier to find a good apartment in Manhattan. You know, it's just like totally impossible. And all I went to all the ashrams and asked them, and everybody was turning me down. So I actually spent at least a week or two looking for a cave. And then one day I was walking through the forest in a direction I'd never gone, sort of downstream. And I came to this spot that was very beautiful and also very quiet and peaceful. And I just was drawn there, and I thought, wow, this is really has a unique kind of stillness here. And so I explored and I walked down this little hill, and then I turned to my right, and there under this boulder was a wooden door with a chain dangling from it. And I opened the door, and it was a cave underneath the boulder. Now, the caves in the Himalayas, there may be, you know, some actual natural caves. In fact, I know there are. I've been to a few. But this one and most of the caves in Gangotri, at least, are man-made. They dig out from underneath a boulder. So they just make a space underneath a boulder and then build up the walls with rocks. So, and so I went in there, and it was dank, and it leaked. And it really, you know, it just smelled like wet earth. And I thought, oh, this is perfect for a human-sized rodent. But no way, I can't stay under this in this cave. And so I kept looking. In other words, I was a prima donna. And I found a swami who had another cave. And I asked him if he knew of any caves. And he said, yes, I'll help you. And he brought me to these several very broken down caves that were just terrible. And finally, he brought me back to this one that I had discovered on my own. And we walked in it, and he looked at me and he said, first class cave. And I saw through his eyes, absolutely true. This was a first class cave. And so I said, thank you. Can I have this? And he said, sure. So that was how I found the cave. And then I discovered quickly that caves are refrigerators. Most of the sadhus, as much as the people do take the caves, most of the Indian, you know, renunciates, these sadhus, they don't really want a cave because it's so cold in the cave. They never warm up. Even in midday, it won't get above 50 degrees. Excuse me. And actually, during the night, it gets down to about freezing. And so they prefer huts, which the sun warms up. And so what I found was that I had to buy another blanket, and I had to dress in every single piece of clothing that I brought. Every pair of socks I would put on every night, I put every pair of pants and every pair of shirt and every shirt. And then I would take the two blankets over me, and then I would put my rain poncho over that. And I just barely stayed warm enough to sleep that way. So that's how I dealt with the cold there.
Wow. And I remember Swami Vishnu Devananda, who was the disciple of Shivananda. He lived in a cave and had frostbite. Did you ever get frostbite?
I never got frostbite living in the cave. It didn't actually get, you know, too freezing because it was the summer. But it got, you know, like right down in the upper 30s. So no danger of frostbite, but definitely hypothermia if you weren't careful. And it's interesting you name Swami Vishnu Devananda, because in a subsequent trip up there, this is so funny. This is a total aside that I don't even talk about in the book, but like I think it was the next year or the year after that, I went up again. And I had noticed these beautiful caves further up that had a southern exposure. So the sun was on them during the day, and they were just like luxury caves. And so I went to this ashram that was in charge of them because I saw that these two caves were empty. And I had known one of Amici's main disciples had been Swami Mayananda. And I don't know, do you know Amici? Have you ever met her by chance, Dr. Erica?
No.
Okay, you haven't met her. Okay, maybe some of your listeners have. She takes a tour of the U.S. every summer, and she and her entourage used to stay with us in Seattle. So they just stayed with us several years, so I got to know the swamis that are around her. And this one day, this swami, he had this beautiful white shirt on, you know, the Indian-style shirt, and I just was admiring it. I said, that's a really beautiful shirt. Where do you get those? And he said, oh, here, I'll give this to you. And I said, no, I didn't mean that. I just wondered where I could order one. And he said, no, I insist, you take this. And he insisted, and he gave me this shirt. And it was wonderful, but I really felt bad for taking it. And I later learned that he only had brought two shirts for the entire world tour that he was doing, or the whole U.S. tour. So I had one of his shirts. That made me feel even worse. But so I was, this is the backstory of this. So I was up at this ashram asking this fellow, and we got to talking, and somehow he mentioned Swami Mayananda, if I knew him. And I said, yes, I know him. In fact, he gave me a shirt one day. And this guy said, hey, that's funny. He had given me a shirt too. And this was just like in some remote corner of India. We both knew the same guy, and he had given each of us his shirt. And so he allowed me to stay in that cave in that year. So I had a much nicer cave that year. But anyway, that's an aside. So that's the adventure of trying
to
find a cave. Don't, yeah.
So you also experienced the army and all kinds of things, but we won't have too much time. And I would love you to talk about some of the principles or things that you've discovered, like the difference between thinking and being in the present.
Beautiful question. Yes, I mean, this was the thing. The whispers, the title of the book, Whispers of the Himalaya. These whispers, you know, when I was meditating, I don't know how many hours a day, probably at least 12, some at most 16, so around maybe an average of 14 hours a day. And when you're meditating that much, your whole awareness gets very fine, and you start having a lot of revelations and insights. And all the more so in a place like this, which really is a beautiful, natural environment. It's like having Yosemite Park all to yourself. It's the most magnificent beauty. And so very inspiring, deeply silent, and a very sacred place. And so I was having these insights and these revelations, and I would write them down. And those are the whispers of the Himalaya. So sprinkled throughout the book are these whispers in italics, so you can recognize them. And around those are the adventures that I had up there. But this one whisper that you're referring to was that I realized that thinking is always about, for the most part at least, the past and the future, whereas being is just being in the present. It's beyond thought. And so that was the insight I had in that moment, you know. And of course, when the insight comes, it's not just a thought, it's not an idea, but it stems from your experience in that moment. So for whatever length of time that day I had, you know, felt the thoughts drop away, thoughts of past, thoughts of future dropped away, and I was just being, and just one with that fantastic, beautiful nature around me. And so that's the kind of insight that was happening there, you know, several times a day usually.
So I have a few more questions, like, why is it important to be silent during a retreat? And why is it valuable to have an austere condition rather than total comfort?
Wow, beautiful questions. Okay. First, the silence. So what I've learned over the years and is that meditation, and there's a lot of aspects to it. You know, you're increasing awareness. That's very important, that mindfulness aspect. But there's another dimension, which is also increasing the energy, the subtle energy, building that up and conserving that, because that subtle energy works on the subtle body to open the nadis, the subtle channels for the flow of energy. But then that also relates to the biochemistry. It starts to change your biochemistry. And we could go into that for as much as you wanted to, but that gradually transforms your biochemistry to, you know, like, for instance, you can be, if you're depressed, you have a certain biochemical markers. And that's why they try to adjust that with medication, you know, same if you're anxious, you know. So those conditions, there's a biochemical basis. Likewise, there's a biochemical basis for higher consciousness, for bliss consciousness. And it's very different than the biochemistry we ordinarily find. And so science may not have identified those things, but it's true. So when you're meditating, you're building up this subtle energy, and that transforms all these levels of the body. Now, one of the things that helps to build that up is by maintaining silence. We actually spend a fair amount of energy when we speak. And so by maintaining silence, it builds us up, and you start to have just this inner sunlight that of happiness and fullness. And so over time, that observing silence is a wonderful thing. And of course, it's been a tool of mystics in all the world's great, you know, mystical traditions. So it's a universal principle, basically. So that was the, you know, first question. What was the second one that you asked? Now I've forgotten.
It was something to do with austerity. Thinking, because you talk about that, but I'd like you to just talk more about it. But it came to my mind right now that the way that addiction, substance abuse centers are working nowadays is they're creating these beautiful environments with lots of interaction and lots of activities, not the austere environment that they used to have. When I taught health and physical education, I used to have speakers come. They used to be austere and give someone what they called a haircut to get over a drug substance. So anyway, talk about the austerity and the value of that.
Okay, beautiful point. And I can't speak to the drug addiction aspect, but I can say that this is another aspect that's kind of a universal thing about spiritual growth. And in fact, I remember used to be a great student of St. Teresa of Avila and St. John of the Cross, and they referred to this very much. And in fact, there was a passage in one of St. Teresa's books where she said, spiritual practice won't give you benefit unless you're doing it in an austere environment. And that was interesting. I didn't really agree with it at the time because I preferred my comfort, of course. But what I can tell you is this, that in an austere environment, it brings up all your attachments, and all these impressions of past experience start to come up. It's like you're almost flushing them out, and you have to just witness them, you know, coming up, your desire for comfort. Like, here I am in this freezing cold cave, and I dreamt about having a propane heater, you know, almost daily, you know. You have to basically struggle for the basic nourishment of some food and water. So you really have nothing. It's down to the nubbins, you could say. And so, but what that does is the impressions of past experience and all the comforts you've had and family and friends and all of these things start to come up. And this is a process where you're actually purifying what they call the chit, the subtle level of consciousness, where these impressions are stored, so that when you then finish your retreat, you have a more open, unconditioned experience. You're not seeing the world through this veil of subconscious, perceptions and experiences that you've had, the sort of impressions of those. You're sort of open and free in a kind of virginal consciousness that you can just experience this moment as it is and not through that veil of conditioning, you could say. So that is really much more accomplished when you are in an environment that stirs those attachments up, so that you have to deal with them and witness them being sort of flushed out of your system, and you gain the inner strength to not be sort of seduced by those tendencies and those attractions. So that's it, and then you're kind of, you gain a freedom from that. So it's just part of the process. I'm not as extreme as Saint Teresa of Avila in the sense of saying that any other, you know, any spiritual practice has to be done that way, but I see the value of what she was saying, and it did bring up a lot of stuff for me because I was in such an uncomfortable situation, you know, and it was even had scorpions and these great big beetles that would now and then come up towards my ears, and I had seen a movie about an explorers and searching for the source of the Nile where some beetle went into his ear and they had to poke a stick to get it out. And I imagined that's what was going to happen to me. Anyway, just all kinds of challenges like that, that bring up your fears. They bring up your attachments and you have to deal with that. Now, if you had a comfortable hotel in the Swiss Alps, which I've also meditated in, there you just got boredom to deal with, or the fact that there's a pile driver outside building another resort, or that noise or something. So much less intensity in that kind of situation than there is when you're really, you know, in a cave in the Himalayas. And mind you, I bring people to the Himalayas now for meditation retreats, and I don't make anybody live in a cave. We live in the best places that we can find. And just being in India is enough for most people, because, you know, it's not as plush as the West. And so if you're used to our Western standard of living, you're going to find out why the Indians want to move to the U.S., why they want to move to Britain in the West, because it is a more comfortable life. So there, it's enough just to be there and have different food and all of that. It can be a challenge enough just as it is. I hope I answered that question.
Billy, absolutely. You made it very clear about the austerity, and that can be read into so many situations, like a person losing the love of their life, either through death or through a divorce, and they can feel devastated and alone, but it's like a state of austerity. They don't have the comforts they had before, and that can bring up everything. So it's not necessarily a negative thing. It's something to go into and get past. But that brings me to the last question I had for you, which is related to all of that, which is, you talk about patience as being a form of love. Well, how do you cope with other people wanting all their comforts and having an attitude and being judgmental? How do you personally cope with that when you know so much about what it is to be a spiritual being and all of that?
Well, that's another beautiful question. You asked some really great questions. I love it. So,
thank you.
Well, part of this growth is that you actually hopefully learn not to be judgmental. And that means you don't judge those who even are judging, because you know you've been there, right? We all have every flaw that exists in humanity. We all have in some form or another. And you, it's really good for your humility to, you have been shown that. And so you you don't judge those who judge, and you don't, you know, you just know that they are also where they're at, and they're going to go through their own process of growth, whatever that may lead them and whatever course it takes. But it's not up to you to judge that. So I try to cultivate a fair amount of equanimity about that. And it starts to become fairly inborn, thankfully, because I know I have my own work. And that's why I brought up in the beginning of the show the importance of integration. And the challenge of that is very humbling always. And so you just can't judge anybody, even if they're judging you.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And you say patience. What does patience have to do with love?
Beautiful. Okay. That was another whisper that I had. It's a whole story, but I better ask, how much time do we have?
We just have a few more minutes, so just briefly.
Okay, just a few minutes. Okay, briefly. I won't get to the story, then I'll just say the thing. I'll say a brief about version. I had up to that point in my life been a little hurried, always trying to accomplish a lot in every day and still get my meditation in, which made it even more urgent that I hurry the rest of the day in order to have that nice long meditation. So but one day I found that I just couldn't hurry. I was being it was like I was just in being and everything was moving at its own pace and I could not hurry it. And it looked like I was going to miss my one meal that day too, because I had been unhurried in meditation, unhurried with my yoga, totally unhurried as I walked into town. I had about a half mile walk or a three quarters mile walk, and I was unhurried there because I just couldn't do anything but enjoy everything. And then I get into town and the soup kitchen that was giving me my meal every day, out of the hut came this Tibetan boy, and he had my meal. He had saved it, and he just gave it to me. It was such a beautiful gesture, and we just pranamed and looked into each other's eyes. He had these moist eyes. It was such a beautiful moment, and in that moment, I realized that that patience is a form of love, because it means that you're fully loving this moment and everything in it, and you don't want it to be any other way. So just this loving this moment as it is and enjoying it, and when you're in that state, you have total patience. So those two are very closely linked, love and patience. So that was the whisper I had that morning, thanks to that experience.
That is so beautiful. So we're coming to the end. So how can our listeners get your book, maybe get in touch with you, and any final words you might want to say?
All right. Thank you. Whispers of the Himalaya. It's, of course, on Amazon, and I think that's probably the best place to get it right now. It's Jayan Boris. You can just search Whispers of the Himalaya. And I also have another book where I give some instruction in meditation, and that's called Effortless Mind, Meditate with Ease. And that's also, you can get that online as well, Amazon or Barnes & Noble, wherever. On my website, this, I would invite anybody who has an interest in this, if you'd like to go to my website, ajayan.com, and that's A-J-A-Y-A-N, and you'll see an offer of a free guided 10-minute meditation. Try that, because you have nothing to lose. And in that 10-minute meditation, when I teach meditation, I integrate working with the energetic body along with the mental body. And that ends up making the meditation much deeper. It kind of opens it up to a much deeper, more effortless experience. And people who try that are usually, pretty surprised how easy it is and how deep they go. And, of course, what's on that free guided meditation is just a taste. It's just scratching the surface, but still it gives you a glimpse of that. And then if you wanted to take it further, I give retreats. I have a membership site where I have all of my courses on video instruction, and you can do it at your own pace. And I have everything from beginning to advanced to super advanced practices. So you can really take it as far as you like. And that membership site is kind of my legacy. It's where I've put everything that I've learned in these past almost 50 years of exploring meditation. And, and so that's it. If I were to say one thing finally, and that is, meditate regularly. And if you haven't already been, instructed such that you're totally confident about your meditation, totally comfortable and know that you're doing it right and you're getting benefits and you're going deep, then if you're not at that point, then definitely get some instruction, because that will save you a lot of trouble and heartache. And without it, you may well give up meditation And that would be a shame, you know, because it is such a beautiful gift.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom on this show today. I look forward to speaking to you again sometime in the future.
All right. And thank you for having me. You're a wonderful interview. I really appreciate your show, and it's been great talking to you.
Thank you. Have a lovely evening. Bye-bye.
Bye.